Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Colm McCann. He's the author, most recently, of a novel called Dancer, published by Metropolitan Books. It's a novel that takes as its occasion the life of Rudolf Nureyev, but it's a novel, I think, about what it's like for someone who comes from an entirely different world to find his way in the arts and via his art into the larger world itself, so that he always remains a stranger. So in a way, Nureyev is something of an allegorical character here.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that really attracted me to Nureyev was the notion that he could not go home, like some mythical creature who was unable to unable to go back to the place he really wanted to return to. So, you know, he could go anywhere. He could walk in to Princess Grace's living room. He could go into the houses of presidents and leaders and dancers and rock stars. And he could literally, he had the pass to the world, except the one pass to by conscious choice, having defected in 61, that he could not go back, because if he went back to Russia, he would have 7 years hard labor. And so that one place that we all sort of need to return to, or need to have at least the idea that we can return to, the home, was denied to him. And so it was a curious sort of 20th century life. For me, I approached it as a sort of strange history of the second half of the 20th century, because this person gets sort of thrown out from where they had grown up and then had to take on the world.
Now, it seems to me that recently, perhaps starting with Michael Cunningham's book, The Hours, we've been seeing more and more of these books that are novels, but which present a recognizable figure in the world. Among them, very recently, there's a novel about Lewis and Clark called I Should Be Extremely Happy in Your Company by Brian Hall, as well as a novel about the finishing of the Ariel manuscript of Sylvia Plath, a novel called Wintering, a novel of Sylvia Plath by Kate Moses. We'll be talking about all of these books on the show. I wanted to know what is giving birth to this peculiar form, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I think once we know the answer, the form will be finished. It's like naming a generation. Once you've named a generation, then, you know, that generation has sort of become a commodity. And once we have the exact answer to what you're talking about, I feel we'll move on to sort of different forms. But it has been around for a long time as well. I mean, if you think of Libra with Don DeLillo, there's dozens and dozens of examples. But it seems to be happening an awful lot now. I don't know why it happened to me.
Well, I begin to locate this, as I was thinking about it, as a kind of project. I first thought about this with Michael Ondaatje, because he had written a poem play biography, Billy the Kid, the collected papers of Billy the Kid. It had photography in it.
Yeah.
And another more straightforward novel, Coming Through Slaughter, about an actual jazz musician.
Buddy Bolden.
Yes. A project gathering up papers, photographs, and writing about the process of the gathering.
Right.
That is to say, asking questions like, what constitutes evidence?
Right.
What do we know other than the facts that displace the facts? What does time
right.
do to an iconic figure?
Right.
Like Billy the Kid or like Rudolf Nureyev in my guest book, Dancer, by Colin McCann. In other words, can a series of transparencies be developed in which the character is at certain nodal points? Here, what the book seems to be about is examining his life between leaps. It's his lifelong goal to achieve elevation and
or
to hang in
the
air. Yes.
Too.
Yeah.
Those quiet things that slip down between the floorboards. Well, what's interesting to me, who was it? Wasn't it Shelley who said that poets were the unacknowledged legislators of the world? And if you think sort of increasingly about how news media have approached iconic figures and how they own them in so many ways, not only inside their profession, but also outside the profession, rock stars and people like that, that they were owned. Or they have been owned in so many ways. And I think a lot of writers are saying, well, hold on a second here. There is perhaps a way that the writer of stories is a legislator of how we approach our history too. Because who's going to tell our history? And if we allow the facts to be shepherded in ways that facts are shepherded. I mean, facts are mercenary things. They can be, you know, taken, packaged, put in a certain arrangement and said, this is the truth, quote unquote. But is there a deeper truth in sort of trying to get at the texture of someone's life?
Well, it seemed to me in particular in Dancer that we're watching the people around Nureyev who are not the people who will ultimately own him.
Right.
Nureyev dispenses with the society figures rather ruthlessly in this book. They buy him expensive gifts and he destroys them.
Right.
He rolls his eyes. He, as in life, he is disparaging
right.
of people who have money rather than passion.
Right.
But the people who tell his story here, by and large, are people like the stilt walker who examines the royal curtain that's being hung in the Russian opera house.
Right.
He works on stilts, and isn't it nice at least to think of him letting Nureyev have a turn on the stilts?
Right.
It's all about everyone having their bit of Nureyev if they are part of the onlooking and loving crowd. In other words, it's almost like a proletarian novel.
Yes.
A lot of the workers, teachers, people who are backstage are going to give us a set of impressions so that what we get is Nureyev as democratic figure.
I'm so happy that you got that because in my approach to it, I wanted to talk about the people who are sort of disenfranchised, the people who've been knocked around, the people who don't get a chance to tell the stories. The man who's a carpenter in the Ufa Opera House who ends up checking the curtain on stilts, the shoemaker, the soldier who battles through the war, the rent boys in the streets of London, the people who are sort of traditionally sort of relegated to the periphery. And, you know, people say, you know, I wrote a book before this called This Side of Brightness where I got to know the homeless people in the subway tunnels of New York. And people said to me, that's very much a social novel. So why are you writing now about, you know, a ballet dancer from Russia? And at its core, I feel, or at least intended to have people feel, that there was a certain amount of anger in this too. But also, I intended to talk about the beauty of these peripheral lives. The man who works in the factory, the man who, the woman who slaves over translations, the people who traditionally would not get to talk about Rudolf Nureyev's life. And the whole story came from years ago. I heard a story from a friend in Dublin. This is how I got into Nureyev's life. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do, and I've never danced or had even a vague interest in ballet, and I had a general interest in Russia because I thought that was one of the untold stories, the 23 million Russians dying during World War II. But I heard this story from a friend of mine who had grown up in the flats in Dublin, the projects, and his father used to come home and beat the living daylights out of the kids all the time. But one night the father comes home carrying a television set, sober. They put in the television set, they can't get a reception, sends kids off to bed with another beating. Jimmy wakes up later that night, goes into the room, plugs the television set in, and carries the TV around the room in his arms. What comes on the television for the very first thing? In the early 1970s, a seven-year-old boy carrying a television? Rudolf Nureyev. And Jimmy fell in love with him. And I thought, well, that's an extraordinary story, because that tells me as much about the life of Rudolf Nureyev as Jimmy, as the projects, as this world that we live in, where our stories now are so simultaneously huge and tiny at the same time. And that, you know, thinking that Nureyev got into the consciousness of a working class boy in Dublin amazed me.
Well, in a way, as I read your book, Dancer, and the books that preceded it, Colm McCann is the author of two previous novels and two books of short stories. The novels are Song Dogs and The Side of Brightness. The book of stories is Fishing the Slow Black River. And there's a book of two stories and a novella, very fine, called Everything in This Country Must. All of the previous books are published in paperback by Picador. But I began to see, in fact, that this is a life of Colm McCann. He comes from a place and from presumably humble origins.
Not really. I'm a sort of middle class kid from suburban Dublin. Yeah, I mean, my father used to come home, and unlike other fathers, like the father I just told you the story about, my dad, you know, didn't drink or anything like that, and he was a good person who introduced me to Dylan Thomas and so on. But no, I'm a middle class suburban boy, and sort of doesn't, you know.
No, but what I mean is that the first four novels are novels very much of the people. They're right. Of the folk existence. And Nureyev begins as a folk dancer. He has an instinct. He's found and essentially trained, but he has a sensibility that comes from nowhere that anyone can name.
Right.
He can be given, his rough edges can be knocked off the way the rough edges of a novel can be knocked off. But this is a very interesting book because, like Nureyev, you begin with the tradition of the people.
Right.
You come to New York, so you too are in exile in New York, and become a writer in New York writing about another exile, essentially not just in New York, but an exile in the world. And there's the sense that the edges are going to be knocked off. Suddenly it's a world that includes the Russian Tea Room and includes Andy Warhol. And this novel is a kind of performance piece.
Yeah.
It's full of the kind of places and settings that you would not find in the other books at all. In other words, this is a gawker in the Museum of Living Culture, huh?
Right. Well, I mean, to me, it was... It's amazing to me. I still don't know where this novel came from. It's that sort of deep, mysterious place that you don't necessarily acknowledge or even want to acknowledge because it can frighten you sometimes. You know, I thought that by approaching those tiny moments in his life, the more anonymous moments, if you will, somehow it seems that I've approached the full story. I was very scared, very scared.
It seems, in a way, something like the Nureyev challenge. Can the boy who's thought of as being a Tatar peasant enter the essentially cultural aristocracy of the great ballet roles?
Which matches the process of writing
exactly.
For me.
Exactly. That's what it seems to me. That's what I was reading as I read this book.
Yeah.
Can someone whose books have been so far books literally of the proletariat and right. of humble beginnings and, you know, enormous poverty and challenges. Can someone follow the trajectory, you know, follow Nureyev? You know, it's almost a question of changing classes and that question of who can tell the story. Can a man tell the story of a woman? Can a straight man tell the story of a gay man? Can a person of the who's been writing of the workers write about the greatest ballet dancer, the greatest male ballet dancer of our time? And some of it is about resisting showpieces, set pieces. Right. One of the impressive things is that the book is not overwritten. It stays within a kind of decorous distance of the elegance of the subject without having to be converted by elegance.
Well, I think it's extraordinary that you bring that up, and because you've just made me realize, like, you know the way writers search for reasons why they wrote things and why they wrote it in certain ways? You've just suddenly sort of slammed into my consciousness one of the reasons I wrote this book was because, in many ways, by taking on that new world, by sort of inhabiting or trying to inhabit the spirit of Nureyev, I was talking about writing and the process of writing and who owns a story, who has the right to tell a story, what is the process of arrogance that goes into inhabiting something that you supposedly don't know about, what sort of leap. And the terror that I had in writing this novel, I think, it has just struck me, is in much the same way that I'm sure Nureyev had terror entering the drawing rooms of the rich and famous and having Warhol as a friend and, you know, having notes from Princess Margaret and so on. That was terrifying for a young Tatar boy. And maybe the reason why people feel that I capture the spirit of Nureyev is because I had equal amounts of terror when I was writing this book and wondering when I was sitting down, where is this stuff coming from?
Well, it was very interesting because when I read Dancer by my guest, Colm McCann, by the way, you're listening to Bookworm and I'm Michael Silverblatt, I had a recommendation of the book by one of the great writers who has written a blurb on its back, John Berger. He had recommended the book and had read several different drafts of it, but I started to think, in fact, a British art critic who has decided that he will be the chronicler of the life of the peasants in Pig Earth and the subsequent books. How interesting. An Irish writer who decides that he will be, temporarily, the chronicler of a whole different life and time and try to enter it not by assimilating it, but by charting the distances of it. And I think that the book is in part about that kind of distance. That is to say, here we have Nureyev and some of the great choreographers and dancers of the time, and yet the book begins with a section about the soldiers during World War II in Russia, frostbite, hunger, and extravagantly bravura section about some nurses who build
baths
in a greenhouse just off the battlefield, how to heat the water, how to divide the tubs. And what happens fascinatingly is that the book is saying almost, what can I tell about this rich and fascinating, complex cultural life that can sit next to the story of the nurses, the soldiers, the blood, and the tubs? In other words, the story of Nureyev is earning its place in the history of the world,
right,
as you write it, next to events that you think of, just by the density of the writing and its intensity, as being of equal, if not greater, validity.
Well, that's, it was wonderful. You're constantly raising the hairs on my arms because, you know, these are questions that that I have been dealing with almost privately and then sort of publicly in the novel, but shrouded, if you will. And these are the things that I want people to think about. And I think of, say, my great hero, one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, John Berger, saying... in a sort of well-quoted line, never again will a story be told as if it were the only one. And if I learned a modicum of, if I could just get a little bit of John Berger into my work, I would be happy and pleased. But I think what John reacted to in the book and what he was pleased by was that I was saying that the life of that soldier who is on the front, who is like literally freezing to death out there on the steps, is as important and travels through not only the geography and not only the culture, but through the blood of people around him into the blood of somebody like Rudolf Nureyev.
There's something that happens toward the end of the book that's very interesting. We meet a figure who acts more or less as the guide to the underground, the host in the gay and drug demi-monde in New York, a man named Victor, who corresponds more or less to the scenester who called himself Victor Hugo.
Exactly.
But when he gets his voice, he is such a monologist that he speaks more than anyone in the book.
Right.
And it almost becomes his story in the final section. His rivalry with Nureyev, which is not a dance rivalry, but a rivalry of presence, turns them into twins of sorts.
Right.
And we get this strange osmotic relationship between two very different gay men who like to see how similar they are.
Right.
And I was wondering about the risks in, you know, bringing such a huge character onto the stage in the last section of the book, who is going to, in a sense, build himself enough scaffolding as a character that he's going to rival the presence of your central figure.
Yeah, that was a risky and at first tremendously difficult thing to do, because I knew that I wanted to get the spirit of the 70s there. I knew that I had to confront this time, and I knew it had to have energy, and I knew it had to have recklessness, and all these things that I was aware of, and that I was sort of afraid to go into. And I was talking to my agent, Andrew Wiley, one afternoon, talking about how I was stuck on, you know, a certain part of New York. How could I go forward? And he told me about the Cuban, Victor Hugo. And in one sentence, he liberated me. But all he told me was like a small little story about Victor Hugo. Talked about him. For about 30 seconds. And then I called up my editor, Reva Hockerman, who's a wonderful editor, and I said, Reva, I have it. I mean, all I needed was those two words, Victor Hugo, and I knew I wanted a sort of galloping sentence anyway, and it ended up being like a 35-page sentence. That's all set in, as you say, the gay culture of New York at the time. And he spends a night in the town with Rudy. But it was... it was risky, I suppose, but I knew I wanted to take it on. And I knew I wanted to have humour and fun as well, because at the time, you know, obviously there was no consciousness of what this sort of behaviour was going to bring, you know, like shoving cocaine up your nose and going into the bathhouses and being with a dozen men at a particular time. You know, people enjoyed themselves back then. People were sort of like having fun, you know. And they really were. And I really wanted to capture that too. I wanted to find this in this character. Even though at the end of the section, he looks at Rudy and he says, here comes loneliness, applauding itself all the way down the street. I wanted to like people to be there you know, and to feel the cocaine going up the nostrils, the tingle in the back of the throat, to walk into the bathhouse, and you know, and these were things that to me were foreign. And as a writer, I had to try, first of all, to research. Secondly, to ask people about. Thirdly, to forget all that I had learned. And then fourthly, to intuit it through language, which is ultimately the only thing that we have anyway. I mean, it all comes down to language, how we slap those couple of words against each other on the page. I mean, this is the great thing that we have.
And to be sure, you end in a world as lost now as Nureyev's Russia. You know, this is a completely past culture.
Right.
Well, not completely, but it doesn't exist the way that it had. The New York of the 70s, the
right.
gay New York of the 70s, is something that we won't see.
We won't see it again.
Yes.
We will not see it again.
And so much of the book is about the imagination of a thing that will be lost, that records and photographs are well and good, but it's a testament to the act of imagination, the ability of the imagination to create the thing that is not of our time and simultaneously permanent.
Exactly. And you know, I have had quite a few people who sort of were in that scene, were in Studio 54, or who were on the west side of Manhattan, who used to be go down to the trucks, come to me and say, well, you know, you're a straight writer with two kids who's sort of like white middle class, you know, and, you know, I'm angry at you for taking this thing on, and I'm even angrier at you because you captured it and you made me relive it again. And they say, well, how is it possible that you did that? And I don't know. I suppose I'm lucky, but I do believe in the power of being able to tell the honest story. And if you attempt to tell the honest story, as the great Berger does constantly, for instance, that something will happen to you, and you will find the language there that's sort of buried in some sort of genetic. This deep, mysterious, genetic, cultural, whatever it happens to be, that we all have the stories. We all carry the stories around in us. And if you lurk around and if you look around hard enough, that these things can come out.
I've been speaking with Colm McCann, author most recently of Dancer, published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you, Colm, for joining me.
Listen, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You can read the first chapter of Dancer on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.